This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we will have today Meredith Colias-Pete from the Post-Tribune to talk about the stories that she has posted online as well as in print this week, and we'll also have a conversation with John Gard, who is a reporter for the LaPorte Herald-Argus and the Michigan City News-Dispatch. He has stories that we'll check in on from LaPorte County for you, and we'll also bring back a good conversation with Chicago reporter Kaylin Belsha about the story that she wrote. And we'll also have other comments as well, too, here on Reporter Roundtable Thursday. But it all gets started after the news. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. That's when we call on reporters from Northwest Indiana Media to talk about the stories that they have highlighted in print as well as online for the weekend. Let's start out by talking with Meredith Colias-Pete, the reporter for the Post-Tribune. Hi, Meredith. How are you today?
Good, Chris. Thank you. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. And in spite of the growing economy, it seems that there's still a lot of young people that are in trouble. At least they need help social services-wise. And in fact, you had one of your stories this week talks about that, about the latest Kids Count It data book that just came out this week. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, every year the NEEKC Foundation that's out of Baltimore and the Indiana Youth Foundation releases a Kids Count report. It's basically a collection of a lot of different statistics and trends that affect children about 17 and below. And as you mentioned, what they're finding is looking at sort of trends since 2013, between 2013 and 2015, you're finding very positive signs of the economy improving. The level of kids in poverty in Lake County and Porter County are dropping. The number of food insecure kids is dropping a little bit. It looks like average incomes are going up slightly. But as you mentioned, you are finding sort of kids entering social services or in need of social services at the same time are increasing, especially since 2011 or so.
Mm-hmm. I know that the report also talks about not only about child poverty, but also, too, about the problems that the opioid crisis seems to be creating for young people all across the state and here in Northwest Indiana, too. And I also had a chance to talk with Tammy Silverman earlier this week about that, and she was referring about the problems that that youngsters have that because the family members may be addicted to opioids or other drugs for that matter, too, that they're not being watched carefully, they're not being tended to as they should be as kids, they're not living the life that kids should be leading.
Right, and Mary Beth Bonaventura, of course, who is a former Lake County juvenile judge and formerly director of PCS in Indianapolis, gave a resignation letter back in December, sort of criticizing Governor Holcomb. For the past couple years, of course, she's been very alarmed at the effect of the opiate crisis that it's having in families of the state. And if you look at some of the figures that you find in this latest Kids Count report, you see, for example, the number of foster children has increased by about 58% over the course of 4 years statewide. The reasons for that, how much that you can directly tie to the opiate crisis isn't known. But, in these cases, you're looking at 89% due to some sort of neglect, 59% due to some sort of substance abuse, either drug or alcohol, on the part of a parent. So you can sort of draw some conclusions on that end, of course, too.
Your article in the Post-Tribune goes into more detail as to how the economy may be improving, but youngsters are still not seeing all the benefits of that as well, too. And you talk about it was interesting to see the information that you had in the article about median household incomes and how they seem to be on the increase in Porter and in LaPorte County, Porter and Lake Counties as well, too.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one thing that you're seeing, as the recession fades away a little bit, you are seeing like incomes, for example, that are, increasing a bit in Lake and Porter County.
Let's also talk about another article that came out this week, and it gets a little closer to home, beyond just the statewide numbers and how the numbers shape up in Northwest Indiana. It was a story about the bill that is involving the Gary School Board and how it's gotten through the Indiana House, and it's now on its way to the Indiana Senate.
Right, and this particular bill is part of a larger bill that is going to give Ball State, or looks to give Ball State, control to run the Muncie School District. Of course, as you'll remember last session, there was Senate Bill 567, which passed and was signed into law that essentially authorized the state takeover of both Gary and Muncie Schools. And so here we are 6 months later, and part of this larger Ball State bill includes some more restrictions on the Gary School Board. Now, last year, they were effectively stripped of their power, and authority for running the school district now is with an emergency manager, Peggy Hinckley. Since that time, you've seen a lot of the school board members, very kind of vocally express, frustrations that they don't really have any power. They kind of allowed to meet about once a month, but they can't really do anything. Now, this latest bill, what it would do for them is reduce an elected school board to an advisory committee for Peggy Hinckley. They would be, instead of meeting once a month, they would be reduced to meeting about four times a year, and Hinckley would no longer be required to meet with them. She would instead be required to hold a monthly forum for the residents of Gary to sort of give them updates on how they're doing improving academics and improving the massive debt that you see there in the district.
Now, Meredith, I also know, too, the article also not only talked about that part of the bill, about the school board and how the impact that the bill would have on the Gary Community School Board, but also talked about Gary Community School teachers as well, too, the power that the emergency manager would have under that bill to be able to make some changes, midway through the year.
Right, and if you're an employee working for that school district, this is really the most important part that you should be looking at. State law right now really only says that if you're a school district, for example, that you can only lay off teachers and staff sort of at the end of the year in the spring. What this legislation would do is it would allow for very specifically for what they designate as a distressed unit, which is pretty much Gary at this point. It would authorize a second round of layoffs. It kind of would give them the emergency manager now the power to do that starting in late September or so. And she would be allowed, if she felt it was necessary, to lay off up to 5% of full-time certified staff.
Now, I also know that, and you'll appreciate this, because since you covered this story and others for the Gary Community Schools as well, too, last evening on the stage, near the stage at the Glenn Theater in Gary, during the legislative public forum, one comment came up from the audience. It happened to come from the president of the Gary School Teachers Union. She obviously does not approve of the bill, and she's very concerned about the impact that would have on not only the economics of the matter as far as teachers are concerned, but also the school board in general. So she's very much opposed to the changes as well, too. And I understand that even the Gary's mayor has something to say about this.
Yes, absolutely. Karen Freeman-Wilson obviously has been kept up to date on what sort of happens with the Gary School Board. She is very much in the loop, and she is opposed to this bill, certainly, for a couple of reasons. Her point of view certainly is that the Gary School Board, historically, many members have a lot of institutional knowledge that, would be of value to the emergency manager, for one thing. And another thing, too, obviously, as a lawyer, that she sort of sees the writing on the wall that this legislation may hold for them, and, wants to make sure that they, what role that they do play, should be sort of safeguarded in law. And she does not obviously see that with this new law, or new bill, excuse me.
We're talking with Meredith Collius-Pete with the Post Tribune about the stories that she had featured in print and online this week. And you had a chance to get some information from the Bishop of the Diocese of Gary, Donald Hying, about the status of the parochial school system, in particular Andrean High School. And tell us what you've learned in that conversation, and also in the statement that he put out.
Sure. This is kind of a situation that we've been watching for a few months now, since the fall. Last spring, the diocese commissioned a report where they are looking at their schools, and they're looking at youth ministry, and they kind of want to, you know, look at what their future needs are going to be and how they're going to plan for that. Of course, the big part of that was they were looking at the possibility of moving Andrean High School to land sort of in Crown Point. And they were sort of, the purpose of the study was kind of just to run the numbers to see how much that would cost. Mm-hmm. Bishop Hyatt has told us that, you know, estimates came out to $50 million, if not more, you know, to build the new building and to keep it up and, you know, maintain it for years to come. And they ultimately concluded that they, you know, wouldn't be able to carry that cost at this point. You know, they haven't ruled it out for the future, but at this point, Andrean is going to stay, it looks like, on Broadway in Maryville.
Yeah. I get the impression, and you probably did too, in the information that you had, that they haven't given up on having the building in Maryville, and they just want to do some more studies, that they probably could get more information together to be able to decide to take the right path.
Yeah, and that's what it looks like as well. It's sort of a, this is sort of where they feel that they stand right now, but they are kind of looking, you know, cost-wise, just to see what makes the most sense for them.
Okay. One of the other stories that you had as well, too, Meredith, dealing again with the legislature and schools in particular, is the passage in the Indiana House on a bill that would limit school suspensions and expulsions. Tell us more about that, please.
Sure, absolutely. You know, this particular bill, you know, was written up kind of in response to something that's sort of a growing recognition in education circles. Indiana itself has a high number of kids statewide that they suspend. If you're looking at statewide between out-of-school suspensions and in-school suspensions, the average over the last couple of years has been almost 100,000 kids between the two that have missed school for some sort of a behavioral problem. You know, and advocates for this say that you know, if you're a school administrator or whatnot, and you're going right to sort of the stick approach of, you know, suspending a kid and taking them out of school, then that means, of course, lost learning time. Academically, they may fall behind. And, you know, if you're looking at a kid that's getting suspended or expelled, for example, repeatedly, that's more likely to sort of mean that they may run afoul of law enforcement later in life. And so the push for this is really looking at how can schools take a look at this and look at what they call sort of restorative practice. And it merely means to look at approaches to de-escalate behavioral problems before they reach the point where a kid needs to be suspended or, you know, or expelled, essentially, or arrested and taken out of the classroom.
Now, what's the status of the bill as far as you know now? We know it's made it out of the Indiana House. So obviously, the Senate's taking it up now.
Right. The Senate's taking it up, and we'll kind of see, you know, where things go from there. You know, critics like, you know, Vernon Smith, for example, have said that this definitely is not perfect legislation, but it's certainly an issue that needs examination.
We're talking with Meredith Coleus-Pete, who's a reporter for the Post Tribune, about the stories that she has had online as well as in print in recent days here, and a lot about education. And Meredith, as always, thanks for being with us today, and look forward to having a chance to talk with you again and taking a look at more stories.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're listening to Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Continuing on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, here's John Gard, who's a staff writer, reporter for the LaPorte Herald Argus, as well as the Michigan City News Dispatch. John, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And a number of good stories out of LaPorte County that you got a chance to keep an eye on and put in print and put online as well, too. Let's take up first the story about LaPorte County's tax abatements and what the latest report out of the Office of Economic Development has to say about that.
Sure. The office had reported to the county council on the status of some tax abatements that had been issued over the years, and the companies are required every year to file reports indicating that whether they're on track to meet their job creation goals and their investment goals, which are set. That's what the county gets back for allowing them a break on their taxes, and they reported that those companies had produced 200 jobs last year,
wow,
which was not too bad.
No.
Altogether. It was eight companies altogether.
I know that there has been, and we've talked about this in the past, there's been some great concern about folks in LaPorte losing jobs, about businesses closing up, moving out of LaPorte, and obviously this is something that I'm sure the county officials have been worried about as well, too, to make sure that, and city officials, too, for that matter, making sure that, that there are jobs staying in LaPorte, but also coming into the city as well.
Yeah. Both the cities and the county economic development efforts have really ramped up over the past year, and they've really made some efforts to recruit new employers and to provide incentives for them to create jobs. And it appears they're making some headway, but I know it's an ongoing concern. Yeah.
If you will take a moment and go into just a bit more detail here from the report here about these companies in LaPorte County that seem to be doing very well and have taken advantage of their tax abatements.
Oh, sure. Of the eight companies that have tax abatements, two of them were awarded abatements last year, so they didn't have any new jobs to report. That was Kingsbury Elevator and Haynes International. Job creation is expected from both of them as well, starting this year. Some of the other companies, the other six, were CHP out of Westville, formerly a cancer care center, Dwyer Instruments, Van Air Manufacturing, Cocott Brothers Development. All those companies had made progress toward their goals.
And I understand that there are more, as far as you know, more companies that are in line to get more abatements besides the ones that have gone out already?
The two new ones from last year will file reports, but there has been some other news. There was a company that made an arrangement, kind of a relatively unique arrangement with LaPorte County. The only one other county in the state had made the kind of an arrangement where the county provides a job skills training grant, and the company will be able to retain 45 jobs and create another 131 jobs over the next 5 years. That was sort of a unique approach to attracting some investment.
I also know too that in the story that you've actually got into a bit more detail here about the office itself that put the report out, and they're getting some needed assistance from the LaPorte County government to help keep the office going and doing very well, and some additional money has been set aside as well too.
Right. They were funded for another $75,000 for half of the year, first half of the year, and then they'll come back to ask for the same amount the second half of the year. But this is part of the new approach the county has taken, where it wants to put a new effort into retaining and attracting jobs.
One of the other stories that you had in the newspapers recently here, coming out of LaPorte County, talks about efforts that the county officials are making to get residents signed up for free rave alert notifications. Please explain what the rave alert is all about and why it's important for folks in LaPorte County to sign up for it.
Right. This is a private company that provides notification services you can get alerts on your cell phone or on via email if you want, or by text, by voice, and the county has signed up with Rave Alert to provide that service, and they're encouraging residents you have to create an account to be hooked into the system, and they're encouraging residents to sign up because all sorts of important information will be provided through the system.
One of the other stories you had as well, too, is very interesting about a new addition to health education and healthcare in LaPorte County. It comes in the form of a kiosk. Explain that for you, if you will, please.
Yeah, well, the new development was at the Westville Correctional Center. In Westville, the state had hired its insurance company to provide a kiosk at the state prison for employees. And in this kiosk, employees can have some privacy, step into a phone booth-like device, a rather large phone booth, and then they hit a few buttons and they can connect directly with a physician remotely. And there's also the ability to take blood pressure and temperature and things like this, and measure your heart rate, and then they can also, the doctor while you're online, can prescribe prescription medicine.
That's great.
And Yeah, the thought is that it'll save money in the long term for the state and provide a significant convenience for employees.
Now, which insurer is working with the Department of Correction about this particular project there at the Correctional Center?
Yeah, it's Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Indiana, and they also provided kiosks late last year, in December, Pendleton Correctional Facility. And the thought is that they started at these two places because of employee density. There were a lot of employees at one place, and their 24-hour-a-day operations. And they also looked at emergency room utilization among employees. And thought that the kiosks would be a real benefit.
I imagine it probably does make more benefit to use a kiosk like that to get something and get some question answered or some kind of examination that's made here instead of having to make the trip to the emergency room.
Right. Yeah. It's a visit to the kiosk is $49, which is thought to be at least as inexpensive as going to a clinic or going to see a doctor.
Well, maybe more so. We don't know. So, well, it's interesting to hear about these new developments in healthcare and getting people involved in ways to not only save themselves time and effort to try to get their problems dealt with, but also save money as well too. While we have you with us today, John. We are getting ready for another big spate of snow coming through northwest Indiana. How's the situation shaping up as we go into this next snowstorm coming into LaPorte County?
Yeah, well, we're battening down the hatches. Yeah. I just got off the phone with the county commissioner, Rich Mrzynski, who said that they're going to close all the county offices tomorrow, non-emergency county offices, and they're anticipating, I think I've seen 7 to 10 inches, and then there's also a narrow band that stretches across the northern part of LaPorte and St. Joe County that's going to get even more than that, apparently. Yeah. So all hands on deck.
We have to be ready for it, to be sure. That's to be sure. So John Gard is a reporter for the LaPorte Herald Argus, as well as the Michigan City News Dispatch. And as always, John, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking, and we appreciate your help and the stories, and look forward to having a chance to have you back on again soon.
All right, nice to talk with you, Chris.
Thank you. Same to you. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Let's continue on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio with an interesting story from a reporter who has taken the time to sort through the trials and tribulations of a family who had lived in Chicago, in a very tough neighborhood of Chicago, to northwest Indiana. But unfortunately, they've kind of gotten out of the frying pan and into the fire, so to speak. And let's turn now to reporter Kayla Belsha, who works for the Chicago Reporter, which is an online publication, by the way. You can go on the Chicago Reporter's website and read this in more detail. She's an education reporter, and she tells us about thousands of black students who have left the Chicago area for other school districts over time, but unfortunately they have gotten into segregated school districts like the ones they had just left. Well, first off, Kayla, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
And tell us here about the trials and tribulations of the Saunders family.
Yes, the Saunders family, I met them because the mother, Latrice, she used to be a local school council president here in Chicago, was really well known, very outspoken against the 2013 mass closures that happened here, where Mayor Rahm Emanuel closed 49 elementary schools, the most that any city had closed in the nation, which is still the top number. And so I wanted to see what had happened to Latrice and her family, and so I called them up, and she's like, oh, we don't live in Chicago anymore. We moved to Gary. Actually, her husband told me that, and I was like, well, Gary, what happened? And so they kind of explained to me the whole process. After their school closed back in 2013, they had a really hard time finding another good school in their neighborhood. And that was like one thing on a very long list that they had been thinking about, you know, is it time for us to leave Chicago? Do we want to live here anymore? They felt the rent was getting really high. They couldn't afford anything more than a two-bedroom, and they had, seven people in their family, and so they were really squeezed in there. They didn't like how violent their neighborhood had become. In Austin, the year they left, 60 people were shot and killed or injured.
Wow.
So it was a dangerous place to live. There were drug dealers that were outside of their home, and they just wanted to get out. And so they chose Gary. And one of the big reasons there was because it was affordable, and they were able to buy a home there that they could never have afforded in Chicago. And so their house cost around $13,000. But, you know, what came with that was Gary School.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you note in the article that you can check out, too, if you like, is that the interesting point here about the fact that, of course, the Chicago's public schools have gained their population growth over the decades. And I guess what you could call was a reverse migration, where we've had families from the South come to Chicagoland. And that's been going on since the early 20th century, I guess. But now we have this reverse migration where people are moving out of Chicago to southern communities like Dallas and Atlanta. And in this case here, we have the move from not very far away from Chicago into northwest Indiana. You mentioned about the problems that they have discovered in the move. The Saunders family, I guess, discovered that they thought that the school district was going to be fine, but what is it that they've discovered here about the Gary Community School Corporation that's very interesting and at the same time very troubling?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they loved their school in Chicago, and I think they thought, you know, we'll just go to the neighborhood school and it'll be okay. And you know, Latrice doesn't think the schools are any better. Kenneth, who's her husband, he's not really sure kind of how he feels. He's kind of mixed feelings. But the kids, when I interviewed them, Brittany, she's in 10th grade, Ken is in 11th grade, you know, they told me a lot of things that they were concerned about their education. You know, we all know Gary is going through a state takeover right now. The emergency manager is trying to help clean up the finances. The district's been under-resourced for a really long time. They're competing to keep their kids from charter schools. So it's a really complicated situation, but you know, the kids told me about the problem of having these long-term subs teaching them instead of real certified teachers, and it really upset them because they felt like their education was being shortchanged. Brittany wants to be a neurosurgeon, and she's like, what am I doing with this long-term sub who doesn't know biology? And she's trying to, like, teach me right out of a textbook that she's like, that's not quality education. And, you know, they've watched schools close around them. They left Chicago partly because of a closure, and they get to Gary, and they're having these same enrollment declines, and they're watching schools close, and there's an arts high school that's on the chopping block now in Gary, and the kids are thinking, you know, we're gonna have more kids coming in. We had a career center program close this year, so children came in from that high school. So they're just watching kind of this disruption happen over and over again. And, you know, going without textbooks in some cases, their younger sister has been sharing her textbooks. So they pointed out all these ways that they felt like the budget cuts and the declining enrollment were still continuing to affect them.
Mm-hmm. What have you found in talking with the Saunders family here and the problems that they've run into here and making the move from Chicago to northwest Indiana, to Gary in particular? How have other students in African-American neighborhoods like Austin that have been able to move out and try and find other places to live as well as to be educated, are they running into the same kinds of problems as Gary has?
Yeah, I mean, I think our big finding of our investigation was that, you know, we found these 15,000 students who had left predominantly African-American, predominantly poor schools in Chicago, and about a third of them ended up back in high poverty, very segregated schools in the Illinois suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
So some kids certainly do, you know, make it to somewhere that's more integrated, better resourced, but a lot of them leave one situation and kind of go right back into a similar situation. And here in Illinois, we've been having a lot of problems with school funding equity, which I know has been a problem in Indiana too. And so when they go to these suburbs that are smaller, they don't have kind of the mass of kids to get the resources, super dependent on state aid, you know, they end up kind of being even more under-resourced. Some of these districts are getting, you know, even more shortchanged than Chicago has been from the state. So, they're just really under-resourced communities that people are moving to.
Now, have you had a chance to talk with anybody with the Gary Community School Corporation, either with people directly involved in helping educate the family members or other people that have come across a similar kind of problem?
Yes, I did. I talked with the principal at Westside Leadership Academy, who's been the principal there for about 5 years. And, you know, he told me, he's well aware of the sub problem. He says, you know, I've been trying to get a teacher in here, but no one applied. And how am I supposed to compete with districts that pay their teachers better than I do or that I can? What can I do if no one wants to work here? And, you know, he said he feels like they've done the best they can to make sure that the budget problem isn't affecting their classrooms. He was, like, pretty adamant that he felt like he'd been doing a lot to try to make Westside a better school, to really get teaching and learning up. But, you know, the kids told me that they didn't really feel like much had changed in the years that they'd been there.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things he pointed to, like, you know, trying to mentor these long-term subs, the kids were like, that's not cutting it. You know, that's not really improving the way that the sub is teaching me.
Well, I guess maybe we should probably ask the question, do we have any good news to report about the Sanders family here? Have they been able to improve their lot as dealing from the making of the move from Austin neighborhood to Gary, Indiana? Have they been able to help make improvements in the education as well as their own life in the home?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when I talk with them, they do feel like the move was worth it for them. They think that, you know, having that house is really important to them, having a housing stability. In Chicago, research has shown that African-American students are kind of the most mobile. They move and transfer the most because it's tied very heavily to instability in housing. So once you have a stable home that you can live in, there's all these other things that brings with it. And so they knew that that was really important to them. They were able to start a business being German Shepherds, so they have this kind of new way that they're making money. And, you know, the kids, they're really smart and they're really kind of independent. They learned how to advocate for themselves really early on because of the school closures. Their mom used to take them to these protests, and so they have this mentality where it's, like, really important to stick up for their education. And so Brittany told me this great story where she wrote a letter to her principal with her classmates that was demanding, you know, find us a real science teacher. And she had all of her classmates sign it, like 60 of them.
Wow.
And she said that she felt like, you know, she was emboldened to do that because she'd watched her mom protesting these school closures. And she spoke out and said, you know, I think these closures are wrong. And I know that you're doing this in poor Black communities. And why are you doing that?
Mm-hmm.
So I do think, you know, she's been kind of become more independent because of this. And both of them are looking at colleges. They're getting ready to graduate. So, you know, I think they... We'll see what happens, but I don't think that their lot is totally, you know, down in the dumps there.
Well, it sounds like that they've done very well, I suppose, in the way they've been educated. They've picked up some other education that perhaps they might not have otherwise had they stayed in the Austin neighborhood in Chicago, to be sure. Kaylin Belsha is the education reporter for a publication which is online now called The Chicago Reporter. Used to be a print and online, now just strictly online. Go on to the Chicago Reporter website. Check out the story that she has written about thousands of Black students who leave Chicago for what end up being other segregated school districts. Kaylin, thank you very much for being with us to talk about your story, and the best of luck with you, and I hope to hear about some more stories that you put out too. And
thank you, Chris.
And by the way, the article that Kaylin was talking about was from December 19th of last year, and we had a chance to talk with her a couple days later for Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday. Andy Downs, who is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Fort Wayne.
We have to remember that the process they follow is one that you and I are supposed to be able to follow and participate in. We actually are encouraged to go to the meetings, go to the hearings, to communicate with our legislators. And if they didn't publish a calendar, we wouldn't know when to contact people. So the process is actually fairly straightforward. For a bill to become a law, it has to be introduced in one chamber. It goes through three readings in that chamber, or three votes in that, or two votes technically in that chamber, and then moves over to the other chamber and does the exact same thing. And when we start talking about the second half of the session, what that means is that bills have to make it out of the first chamber, the chamber of origin, by a certain deadline that varies from session to session, and get over to the second one. If it doesn't, then that bill theoretically is dead. And so we are now passing the halfway point where bills have to make it over to the other chamber. This, like I said, is so that you and I can actually pay attention and follow along. And I encourage people, go to the General Assembly's website, iga.in.gov. There is a lot of really helpful information there.
Now, let's first take the House of Representatives. They had their work done on Monday, and now we kind of wait to see what happens in the Indiana Senate today. But there are a number of bills that have made it from the House over to the Senate now, and some of these, of course, have a great impact on Northwest Indiana as well as the rest of the state. Let's focus in first, Andy, about the ones that we here in the region are the most concerned about, or the ones that we hear the most about. In particular, the House bill that has made it over, House Bill 1374, which is sponsored by Ed Soliday from Valparaiso. It's one that deals with how the financing is going to be arranged for the proposed South Shore Line work. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when we look at how much money we spend on transportation, it's a huge amount of money, and there, of course, is a desire to spend even more. But Indiana has long been recognized as the crossroads, and crossroads, people think, just highways. But it's more than that. It's about It's about the ports, it's about rail, it's about the South Shore more specifically, and we sort of keep adding things into the mix little by little, and every now and then what we really need to do is sort of come back and take a look at the totality of how things are happening. So this particular bill, which, as you pointed out, sponsored by Ed Soliday, deals with financing and actually creates an entire new part of the Indiana Code that's an attempt to rewrite various statutes and put them into one place in terms of the Indiana Finance Authority, so that theoretically these things might be done a little easier and in a way that's a little easier for us to understand as average folks.
Now we know, too, that this just deals mainly with the state funding. There's a whole separate federal government aspect of the funding in this, and that hasn't even been taken up by Congress or anybody in Washington, D.C. yet, other than just discussed, I'm sure. But this all has to start, I guess, first with the groundwork that has to be laid so that the state funding, wherever it may happen to come from, is going to go to the right places.
Exactly. And today, so many of the transportation projects, whether it's rail or highway or even air, involve some sort of blending of financing from the federal level as well as the state level. And you know, sometimes you get very lucky and it's something like an 80-20 mix, 80% of it covered by the feds, 20% has to be covered through the state. Those, obviously, we like those because it's our tax dollars and other people's tax dollars coming to Indiana. But you still have to come up with the 20%. And there usually are timetables by which you have to spend the money. Not only is the South Shore one of these things that we're trying to figure out how to expand and make more useful. I know I love it. I never drive into Chicago any longer. I take the South Shore.
Yeah.
But there are other projects down in Indianapolis, for example. They're trying to develop a better public transportation system as well. And then there's always the talk of high-speed rail running across the northern part of the state. We'll see where that goes. That, I like to say that has the longest shot, I guess, of the things that are being discussed. So we'll have to wait and see what happens.
And we know that one in particular is certainly of interest over your way there over in Fort Wayne, because we know that the part of that route that would be proposed by the high-speed rail would end up going to over to Fort Wayne and then points to the south of there. So it's a very, very expanded plan compared to just what we face here at the South Shore. But just the same, we're all waiting to see what happens, and this is what's going to come about, to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other measures, or several of the other measures, actually are ones I'll let you take up here that deal with a number of different subjects, like workforce development and handguns and that sort of thing. Fill us in, if you will, on some of the measures that have made it out of the House, now headed to the Senate.
Yeah, the session was described as a workforce session, and that's in part because that's part of what the governor talked about, and that's in part because the leaders in the two chambers were trying to give the session some focus. Virtually every year there's something that gives the session focus. Obviously, in the budget year, it's easy to say it's the budget that provides the focus. But in the other years, and even in budget years, sometimes there are other things. And workforce development was one of those things. The issue with workforce development is that there are a number of entities that provide workforce development, either oversight or provision of services and provision of revenue. And it's, some would argue, not working quite the way we would like to see it worked. Keep in mind that right now we're looking at some really low unemployment in the state of Indiana, but we're still trying to attract new businesses here. And the governor and some other people are saying we need to be able to respond faster. We need to make sure that our employees, our residents are ready to work as soon as those jobs get here. And there's a belief that it's just too convoluted right now. And so the hope was to try and get all of these things worked out. It is the legislative session, so we never say that anything is done until it's signed by the governor. There are some people who think that we still might see some workforce development legislation coming out. There are other people who say, no, it's not going to be that. Instead, it'll be some sort of a study committee
mm-hmm.
that sets us up for doing that in a budget year, which is really the good time to do it because so much of that is contingent upon money coming from the budget. So this may have just been the appetizer, so to speak, to get us ready for actually doing something next year.
Okay. Now we talk about handguns. I know that one measure just made it out of the House and headed to the Senate here. It deals with the licensing of handguns in Indiana, and that's a change from the past. So I guess it's something that if it does become law, we'll have to get used to.
Yeah, it's the idea of legislation, or excuse me, the idea of permits, et cetera, it's an interesting thing. There are a lot of people who are fans of the idea of a lifetime permit, for example. There are other people who have the opposite opinion and say, no, we should actually shorten the number of years that someone can, that somebody doesn't have to come back and re-up for their license. There's also an issue of reciprocity that's happening at the federal level, and that's playing a bit of a role here in Indiana. Basically, though, yesterday the House did vote to remove a fee for a lifetime carry permit and increases the number of years of the current permit from 4 years to 5 years. And so those are the two big things. A couple of other things have fallen off the way. For example, permanent lifetime for virtually everyone. I think I'm oversimplifying, but there was somebody who was a big fan of basically removing the need for a permit of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're looking at right now is something that is a little more narrowly tailored so that there's a no fee for a lifetime carry permit. And if you get a permit in the conventional way, it's a 5-year permit instead of a 4-year permit.
One of the bill that was sponsored by State Representative Charlie Brown of Gary dealt with the problem of not enough pharmacies, and particularly in low-income resident areas. And that's what his measure, House Bill 1382, was all about. And he's asked for a lot of more study into the idea that residents should be sure that they are able to get their prescription filled regardless of where they happen to live.
Yeah, the idea of deserts, that's not a new one. We've talked about food deserts for a while.
Right.
There's been some attempt to address those. But when you think about areas of the entire state, you can easily find areas that are underserved in a lot of ways, and pharmacies would be a good example of that. You know, some of us live in places where you can find a pharmacy, you know, within a half a mile or a mile of where you're living, and other places, not at all. But this is one of those things. In Indiana, we very much believe, at least we say we believe, that businesses should be free to do what they want to do, when they want to do it. In other words, be successful and start your business, be an entrepreneur, and we don't want to put limitations on businesses. But the reality is there are some places that are underserved. And the question is, when does the government step in to try and deal with that underserved issue? I think it was very smart of Representative Brown to go for a study committee here. No one was going to be interested in passing legislation that mandates that the state somehow provide pharmacy coverage in places where it's not, because there would have been a fight. Are these urban areas that are the deserts, or are they rural areas that are the deserts? And that just would not have gone well. So I think this is a good approach to it. We'll have to see what happens, though, because this is, in many respects, people theoretically asking the government to be much more proactive about something than it normally is when it comes to the economic sphere.
We're talking with Andy Downs, who is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics in Fort Wayne, about the bills that have made it out of the 2018 General Assembly session in the House. There were some education-related bills, too. I know about school discipline and diplomas that have made it over there. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, the diploma one might be the one that gets the most attention.
Mm-hmm.
People right now are saying this is something that had to happen because of the change from No Child Left Behind to Every Student Succeeds the Most. That's the bill that took the place of No Child Left Behind at the federal level. And the states basically had to make some kind of an adjustment. One of the issues was how states were scored in terms of graduation rates. Indiana, in terms of our classifications of high school diplomas, had some issues that we needed to address, and there were competing theories about how to approach this. There were some people who wanted to make changes right away, very quickly, a lot of people would say, did not get input from educators, you know, the professionals, the way they should. And other people said, well, no, these changes are actually what the job market is looking for, and these are good changes. We'll have to wait and see how they play out, which is the usual case when major changes to education happen. The folks who really want to be looking at are folks like Bob Boehning. He had a bill in particular, 1426, that was about the diplomas. So that's a bill for people to look at. One of the things that people like about that bill, not that people don't like the parts I've mentioned already, is that there is an attempt to create basically a diploma for students who are learning disabled. who have cognitive disabilities so that they are actually earning a diploma as opposed to earning a certificate or something else. The diploma would be the way for them to actually suddenly be qualified for a number of jobs that they're automatically written off from because the job says you need a high school diploma. So there's some good and some bad in there, but it's one that people who, especially if they have children who are in school right now in the lower grades, they should take a look at 1426 and start following this one pretty carefully, or at a minimum, contact the superintendent slash principal slash favorite teacher, whoever, you know, whatever you want to say, in their public schools and talk with them about this one. It's an important one, very, very important.
I know one other education-related measure that has been up for debate and has been moving through the General Assembly is one that the school boards, not only in Gary but also in Muncie, are very, very concerned about, and it's about a change that would come about in education with the takeover districts that had problems and what the state says they want to do, and in particular, who's going to represent these people on their relative boards that they have. Some of these people are really up in arms because these elected boards don't have much say.
It's true, and you think about it, the school boards throughout the entire state have lost say in what they do because the state took over funding of K-12 education. Now, on the one hand, it was good the state took that over, but at the same time, local school boards lost some flexibility in what they want to do or could do regarding funding. But that's eroded further when you start talking about the state, quote, taking over a school district, and obviously Gary and Muncie are the two that people are focused on right now,
right.
With the goal of universities actually taking them over, limiting further, the argument is, input from the public into what's going to happen in those school districts. Obviously, whenever a takeover has to take place, whether it's an individual school or a school district, I personally believe it's imperative that whoever does that takeover be in constant communication with the people who are served by that school or that school district. This will be tricky because a lot of people will see the takeover as needing to sort of right the ship financially and just begin making changes that will be viewed as detrimental without getting much public input.
Well, we talk about the measures that have made it from one house over to the other chamber and will be reviewed over in the Indiana Senate now as they move ahead. Well, how about the bills that didn't make it? There's some interesting ones that are out there that have kind of fallen by the wayside this year.
Yeah, and the one that some people will be disappointed by is the cold beer sales, but then they'll be happy because the Sunday sales bill is moving, so that one's fallen by the wayside. It's unlikely to see a legalization of medical marijuana. That's another one that probably won't become law anytime soon. Then there are still in the sort of serious range are things like the hate crimes legislation. That's fallen by the wayside. And actually a bill that was going to change smoking age to 21, that one died as well. Some things that were maybe not quite as some people would say important. There was a bill introduced that was going to require the Colts to refund money if any of the Colts players knelt during the national anthem.
Awesome.
You know, there are always things like that that almost always end up falling by the wayside. So that's another one that people are probably happy to see not move forward. Other people, I'm sure, will be disappointed. And then there was a bill that would have actually pretty much become a total ban on abortion in the state of Indiana. That one's also not moving. There are a number of social conservatives who are upset about that. And one of the arguments for the bill not moving forward has been that the bill was obviously in conflict with current law and current court rulings. And the people who like this bill are saying, but we have a different court now, and we want a court challenge. We want a bill to work its way up to the Supreme Court. And Indiana's as good a place as any for that bill to come from. But that's probably not going to happen this time around either.
Can you give us an idea of what you see as are going to be the measures that to watch here in this second half of the General Assembly session?
It becomes more complicated to watch things in the second half of the session because people can start amending things into bills. But and this is, I think, maybe the most important thing for people to know. I was talking with some professional lobbyists last week, and it seems like every session there is at least one thing that sort of blows up, and sometimes we know what it's going to be, sometimes we don't. But there's something that blows up, it lets the legislature let off some steam and then they sort of get back to productivity. We haven't seen that yet, and maybe this will be a session where that doesn't happen or doesn't need to happen. So it could be that the dynamics of the legislature itself are what change cause us the things to happen in the second half of the session. So that's one thing that I think people should watch out for, just that. And then I'd go back to the diploma bill, the education bill that I mentioned earlier. I think that's an important one for people to keep an eye on, in part because we spend so much time and effort on education, not only in terms of resources, but the legislature working on things, Department of Education working on things. Anytime people start talking about education bills that are moving, I think they're worth watching because they can make a pretty significant difference in people's lives.
Andy, thank you very much for being with us and giving us a clue here on how this first half of the session went and what to look for in the second half of the 2018 session.
It is always a pleasure being on. Thanks for having me.
That's Andy Downs, who is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Fort Wayne. Ball State University is partnering with state workforce and education officials to help bring out an innovative and entrepreneurial spirit among high schoolers in Indiana. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Val Jones reports, that the result is a statewide business pitch competition with some very lofty prizes.
What business concept would you pitch if it could bring you a college scholarship, corporate internship, and $10,000 in cash? Candy Dodd is a project manager for the Innovate Within competition. She says even before the program's registration deadline, the ideas coming in are interesting.
The two that I have seen have been reusable baggies. So if you're packing your lunch and you have those little Ziploc baggies, plastic ones, they've created this little pouch that is reusable. So it has Velcro on it. And the other one is a car detailing on the go.
Organizers say around 200 students around Indiana have applied so far. Applicants will first compete regionally, and some will eventually move on to a statewide in-person pitch finale in Indianapolis in April. The deadline to register has been extended to February 13th. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Val Jones in Muncie.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for being with us, and thanks to our reporters joining us for Reporters Roundtable Thursday. From the Post Tribune, Meredith Colius-Pete, John Gard from the Herald Argus and the News Dispatch in LaPorte County, and from the Chicago Reporter, Kaylin Belsha, and Andy Downs with the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics in Fort Wayne joining us as well. Thanks very much. I'm Chris Nolte, and we'll be back with you on Monday.